This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The plan for three new casinos in the state to be built quickly to take on the coming assault from Massachusetts has been scaled back to one casino with no final vote coming until 2016. The state house acts on a bill to provide drive-only licenses and in-state tuition to undocumented residents on a week when the word racism hijacked the debate at the Capitol. And lawmakers looked into regulations concerning a new product that may signal the end of civilization as we know it, powdered alcohol. Those are just a few of the stories we'll tackle today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Bill Curry is here. He's a columnist for Salon.com and our political analyst. Hello there, Bill.
Morning, John.
And Daniela Altamari. She's the State House reporter for The Hartford Current. Hello, Daniela.
Hi.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Come and hit our website, WNPR.org/where we live. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. If you can't get to sleep at night, you can also watch us on CTN, the Connecticut channel. We're sometimes there on television. Their cameras are here to capture us live and in person. Speaking of the end of civilization, we were a bit snarky about President Obama's rant about climate change at the White House Correspondents' Dinner at the end of his skit with Luther, his anger translator.
Every serious scientist says we need to act. The Pentagon says it's a national security risk. Miami floods on a sunny day, and instead of doing anything about it, we've got elected officials throwing snowballs in the Senate.
Okay, Mr. I think I got it, bro.
It is crazy. What about our kids? Okay, what kind of stupid, short-sighted, irresponsible bull?
Whoa! Hey!
What?
Okay, no, hey!
See, the joke is that Obama really can get upset about something, and it's climate change, which if you live along the coastline or in Alaska or just about anywhere that food or storms or animal species might be important, it's really not all that funny a joke. It seems he is serious now, though, as the president plans to use today's commencement speech at the Coast Guard Academy in New London to cast climate change as posing an immediate risk to our national security. In just a moment, we'll be joined by our own Harriet Jones, who's going to be covering the president live for us today at the Coast Guard Academy. But first, Colin, I'll go to you. This is something we've been talking about for quite some time here. It seems like the president is going to use our little state as a place to finally start talking about climate change in a really serious, substantive way.
Yeah, and he's just talking about sort of devoting quite a bit of energy to this in the remainder of his term. But that's kind of the key, the remainder of his term. I mean, it turns out the only time that you can actually devote yourself to something that is every bit as serious as he was implying in the comedy skit that you just heard is when you don't really have to risk any political capital anymore. You've got nothing left to lose. I mean, this was really an urgent problem, I don't know, like 14 years ago, and it certainly has been an urgent problem for as long as he's been president. And so this really is the personification of too little, too late. I mean, I'm glad he's doing it instead of not doing it, but it is too little, too late.
Too little, too late, Bill. I mean, it had to come eventually. As Colin said, this has been something that's on the national radar for about 15 or 20 years, and President Obama now, you know, staking a claim.
One of the hardest things in particular for Democrats, but for all citizens to figure out, regarding Democrats, regarding leaders of the Democratic Party, is what do they really think? And it's become such a guessing game. Obama actually gave had a great more than a gesture, but had an accomplishment on climate change with the Chinese Accord just after the last election. But I agree with everything Colin said. It reminds me of these senators, the endless string of senators who give speeches from the Senate floor after they've retired about campaign finance reform and corruption and how they just can't take it anymore. You think, wow, you were there for 48 years and you're just going to mention this on the way out the door. In his first term, Obama gave an instruction to his top appointees not to mention climate change. This was an unconscionable political maneuver. The entire administration went radio silent, and it's one of the reasons why even with the rising tides, literally, public opinion was actually going the wrong direction. Fewer people – there was a constant drumbeat from the Fox News crowd and fewer people believing that what they could see with their own eyes was even true. And the second thing is you get these sort of you get these very contradictory situations between rhetoric and fact. After 6 years of ignoring income inequality, the president gave a State of the Union speech which proposed tax policies consequential enough to shift the tide, that tide on income inequality, wage stagnation, et cetera. And since then, all he's done is push the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which moves us in the entirely different direction. He gave a wonderful speech on the China Day. I'm sure he's going to give another one today. He has opened up more lands
to drilling. The only difference I can see between Sarah Palin's position and Obama's position, quite literally, it comes down to a single national park. Coastlands off a single national park in Alaska. His slogan could be drill, baby, drill. If the scientists are really correct, Democrats are always saying believe the science. If the majority of this science is really correct, you have to keep a lot of this carbon in the ground. Someone has to come out literally and say, we can't open all this up. If these guys are right, then we have to actually leave an awful lot of this carbon in the ground and move much more quickly than we had been. So you get these impassioned speeches in the last 6 months, and then either Trans-Pacific trade or opening up all the oil and natural gas leases for drilling, you get actions that belie them at such a deep level that you're left wondering, what does he really think?
Well, and one of the things that seems to be happening over and over again around this issue is essentially the administration saying, well, let's leave it up to the states to sort of figure out these things, whether or not it's figuring out fracking on their own, as New York did in one way and Pennsylvania did in another way. And Danielle, I know that our governor gathered together the governors of the six New England states. They're talking an awful lot about how to deal with energy issues. They've been talking for quite some time about how to deal with climate change. I mean, as you cover the Capitol and the governor's office, is this something that seemingly the state really has to take on? Because the federal government to this point has not.
Perhaps, but there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of urgency over there at the Capitol either on this issue. You don't hear it being talked about a lot. They have hearings, there's committee meetings, there's bills that come up, but it's certainly not a front burner issue at this point.
It's not a front burner issue. One thing that has been a front burner issue, Bill, as you wrote about this week in Salon, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which Barack Obama probably will not be talking about during his speech today at the Coast Guard Academy. It seems as though there's a whole group of Republicans and Democrats all kind of lined up to say they don't like this trade deal, which is, as you write, more than just a trade deal, right? And maybe you can give us a little sense of what you see in this TPP.
Well, it's two things. When you think about trade, you think about tariffs, quotas, and the like. And this, all of these agreements, but especially this one, go far beyond that. And what they essentially do is they set up a kind of extra-governmental, supra-governmental mechanism for deciding not just trade disputes. There's a phrase called non-tariff trade barriers. And what non-tariff trade barrier means is any policy, any law to protect the public health, safety, or welfare in any aspect of life that another nation thinks impedes their ability to conduct a trade. So that if you have a higher truck safety regulations and they want to move – and the Mexicans want to move their trucks in – if the Canadians these are all real cases that are happening in real times. If the Canadians feel that our financial reforms impede their ability to speculate and their ability to sell government securities, they can challenge the laws we passed after the 2008 meltdown, which they're doing. It happens all over the world. And so what's happening is an attack on democracy, what Ralph Nader called a corporate coup d'etat. There isn't any a single aspect of our social contract or of the governance of commerce which can't be leached out of the democracy and into a kind of star chamber, a much less public, much less democratic, non-due process kind of corporate-dominated decision-making. And this is really the heart of the TPP. It's not about trade among nations. It's about the relationship of global corporations to all democracies. And as such, it's probably the single most important vote that any of these members of Congress will cast. Again, it's hard for them. I know, you know, Joe Courtney's been fabulous on this. Rosa DeLauro's been very good on it. We know where most of our delegation is going because you can't even read the agreement in reality. They're about to vote on this fast-track deal down in Washington. A copy of the agreement itself, and bills in draft form are unreadable. They have so many references that they're so hard to follow. You have to go into a locked room in the basement. You can't bring a cell phone or a tape recorder if you're a member of Congress or a senator just to read the thing. They're going to vote to fast track this, and not only will no citizen know, but no member of Congress will even know what's in it. It's an absolute abomination.
Colin?
To me, that last part is almost the most disturbing. I mean, it, really, the description of sort of where this thing is and what you have to do to go see it, it sounds like the opening credit sequence for Get Smart if you're a person of a certain age. You know, you're just going through these different sliding doors.
I'm old enough.
Yeah. And you know, Barbara Boxer at one point said, what do you mean I can't take notes on it? I mean, even senators are kind of astonished at this. And it really, I mean, to me, it is kind of a placeholder for a whole bunch of things that have happened over the last 10 years that really make me wonder about the status of the American democracy. I mean, the notion that there would be something this important that is being handled in such a highly secretive, restrictive way, as if somehow or other this process and the government's involvement in it existed for some other purpose than to serve its citizens, which seems kind of like a violation of the basic compact here. So, I mean, I sort of lump it in this huge bag of militarized local police forces and, you know, weird incarceration rates and the failure to do anything about Guantanamo. And I just feel like, where did our democracy go?
Oh, where did our democracy go? But very quickly, Bill, where did the Democrats go? I mean, behind Barack Obama, you don't see Democrats lining up to support him on this Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. You see some Republicans lining up, as you write about in your Salon column. These are Republicans who, generally speaking, would say that the sovereignty of the United States government is one of the paramount things that we might want to protect, and they are, in many ways, handing over the keys to big corporations and other governments.
These are people who spend their lives pandering to paranoid fantasies about blue-helmeted UN troops coming in to take us over. They talk about that they don't want Supreme Court justices even mentioning foreign cases. It goes even on your show here, debating conservatives on health care. They'll say, oh, your ideas are so European, you know, as if that necessarily – okay, well, then that's terrible. Okay, let me get rid of that thing.
And so is my
tie.
Yes.
And then along comes a bill they can't even read that knocks every state attorney general, every private citizen 100% out of the system and makes even the federal officials takes even away most of their power. If, in fact, you can take any law and show that it had an impact on your trade, you can go to a three-person tribunal with no right of appeal. They don't even publish the dissenting opinions, and you can that are so dominated by this international corporate class, and have it done there. Where are the Republicans? They're for it. And who's negotiating it, by the way, but Barack Obama, whom they're constantly accused of tyranny, and they want him to do it. But the bigger question – I mean, these are incredible contradictions – but the bigger question is about Democrats. We're supposed to be the party of working people. We're supposed to be the tribunes of the disadvantaged and of the poor and of the aspiring. And our party is so – as I said before, we don't know who's for it and who isn't. All the Democrats voted against Fast Track, and then the next day 11 switched as planned to vote with the Republicans to get the debate going. Of the 33 in the Senate who still oppose it, we're not even sure who really does and who doesn't. It's this giant shell game with no P.
Interestingly, Daniela, Governor Daniel Malloy actually weighed in on the TPP. He wants to protect pharmaceutical companies making some of the most cutting-edge and expensive drugs against competitors who want to make cheaper generic versions of those medicines. One of the things that might come out of this. Even Governor Malloy is talking about this.
Yeah, it's reaching down to the state level, and that's kind of interesting too.
Which is very interesting.
Deeply disappointing letter. Really a letter that, more appropriate to a corporate lobbyist than to a governor of a state, and would have a terrible impact on millions of poor people throughout the developing world and also on millions of middle-class citizens right here in the United States. Wrong move.
A quick tweet from Kathleen that I want to ask you about, Colin. Is a failure to act on climate change, finance reform, et cetera, all the things we're talking about, a failure of the politicians or more truly of us, the electorate?
Well, you know, that's sort of – we're back at the pogo place, right? We've met the enemy and he is us. So obviously – politicians are not in the business of telling us things that we don't want to hear and that we don't want to have to deal with. But politicians are also in the business of leading and sort of in all the ways that we talked about with climate change. Ultimately, the reason that you ran for office, I assume, was that you wanted to lead. And leadership on the issue of climate change really did mean talking about it enough to begin transforming public opinion, because there's a lot of things that have to be done that do involve these huge opinion shifts. And if leaders don't talk about them and almost kind of wear people down and familiarize people with them. You know what as we were talking about this, I just one other thing about this, which is that, you know, we're talking about how it gets pushed down to the state level. And Daniela said, well, but the state level, they don't really care. It's actually also been pushed down to mayors. And, you know, I think registrars of voters are now in charge of climate change. But, you know, because like nobody wants to deal with this. Although mayors in America have shown more leadership on this probably than anybody at any level. And Here in Connecticut, I have to say, you think you could make the case that John DeStefano, among elected officials in Connecticut at any level, has had more to say and has done more on the issue of climate change than anybody else at any level. And that's kind of sad, too. It's like just keep kicking this downstairs till you find somebody who has the kind of political capital that allows them to deal with it.
But I mean, everyone has had to, right? If you're along the coastline in Connecticut, you're essentially forced to cope with this. You're forced to come up with an action plan. How are you going to evacuate your residents in case of a terrible storm? How are you going to deal with floodwaters? How are first responders going to deal with the changes that we see in our environment every day? They're really forced to deal with something that should be, at a certain level, dealt with at a higher level.
Yeah, and obviously, at the point when you're forced to deal with it because of rising waters, you've lost most of the battle, right? I mean, a lot of this stuff is, scientists are telling us, essentially irreversible. There's just no way, short of geoengineering, that we're going to put the brakes on this process.
What Colin's talking about, I just want to underscore for a second. This is one of the most important trends in all of American civic life, that people who – issues we used to look to the Congress for, or absent the Congress, the legislature. We now go to courts. We go to referendum. We go to cities and towns. Los Angeles has just raised the minimum wage by $15 to $15 by 2020. The Congress hasn't touched it since 2006. Gay marriage, the human rights campaign spent a fortune giving money to members of Congress and Senate running for office, but nothing ever got done in the Congress whatsoever. Climate change, when you see climate change devolving down to local officials, the federal government has defaulted on almost every major issue that people care about right now. I could tick through three or four more. And they're going to local governments. They're going to referenda. They're going outside of civics altogether. They're going to courts. Everywhere but to a government that stopped working.
When we come back from a break, we're going to check in with our own Harriet Jones, who's covering the president's speech today. But before we go there, I want to get to David in Woodbury, who's actually calling about something we didn't have on our schedule to talk about, but it's a pretty important issue, something that is near and dear to our hearts, transportation in the state. David, go ahead.
Oh, hello, everybody. Many of us heard on Morning Edition toward the end that Connecticut has the most dangerous rural roads in the country, and this is a shock to yours truly, because when I was a youngster in the 1950s, our good governor Abraham Ribicoff launched the safe driving campaign, and our state became the safest driving state in the country. Now cars are much faster, handle better, people drive faster. Something needs to be done.
Thank you very much for the phone call, and I appreciate it. I'm glad you raised that, Daniela. This is really interesting. We see this report come out. Connecticut's rural roadways, and I live out in the boonies, and I drive on a lot of these rural roads, the most dangerous in the nation. Amongst all the things we're talking about, how to get high-speed rail into the state, widening highways, whether or not that's a good idea, on 84 and 91, major transportation infrastructure investments that the governor's looking at. And here we get this report that says, hey, maybe we need to be looking at how safe our rural roads are.
Yeah, and this is an issue that's come up repeatedly with Route 6 and some of the other issues, some of the other rural roads in the state. And they've been talked about a lot, and it doesn't seem like a whole lot's been done.
Well, not a whole lot's been done, but one of the questions is, for rural commuters, people who have to use these roads, right now there's no other way to get any place than to get in your car and go, and then you're at the whims of deer and raccoons and everything else on the road, including all these curves and all these turns.
Yeah, and fixing all that costs a lot of money, and that comes down to the question, where's the money going to come from, like anything else?
We're going to find out a little bit more about where the money's coming from for some other projects that we want to talk about that are happening at the state capitol today as we continue in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. When we come back, we'll check in with our own Harriet Jones, who's covering the president, New London. We'll also talk about the word racism in politics. It's something that reared its ugly head in a spat between Governor Malloy and Republicans. We'll find out how it ties into some important issues that are being debated there as well. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is the Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosk. It's Wednesday, so that means the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined by Danielle Altomare, who's the State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. We're going to get to some things that are happening at the State House in a couple minutes. Bill Curry's here. He's a columnist for Salon.com. He's writing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership this week in his column. And also joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show this afternoon, Colin?
Well, today, Mr. Dankosk, we have a show produced by young Josh Nalea, who's our resident deep, deep, deep thinker. And so Josh has been thinking about hierarchies and sort of, you know, where do they come from? Are they just ingrained in nature? We certainly see them in nature. And are they necessary? Would it be possible to live with fewer hierarchies? So there you go.
This is a fascinating program. We've been talking a lot about this in the newsroom.
This guy's nuts. Really, that's just amazing, isn't it? Wow. Hierarchies in nature and society.
Exactly.
Does any subject frighten him? Really, is there anything they won't do on that show?
Every subject frightens me.
Yeah. They all frighten me. Right now, though, I want to turn to Harriet Jones. She's WNPR's business editor, who at the start of the program was waiting patiently in line to get her press credentials to see the President of the United States speak to the Coast Guard Academy in New London. Hi, Harriet. Did you get through the line?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I'm sitting on Cadet Memorial Field. You might be able to hear the band music behind me. This is a place where hierarchies are not going by the wayside anytime soon, I can tell you that.
Nice transition.
Well done, Harriet.
Yeah. Well, hierarchies to get in here was quite something. They bust you in from off campus, and you know there's a sniffer dog for your bags and then credentials and so forth. So, yeah, it's a process.
Well, of course, one of the things that we're always interested whenever the president or the vice president comes to the Coast Guard Academy, we've covered these for years. Often, though, the president doesn't use this opportunity to make big policy pronouncements or big speeches. We remember, of course, during the Iraq War, George W. Bush gave a big one. But other than that, we don't hear a lot of big news during these Coast Guard commencement speeches. But this time around, Harriet, it seems though the president might be talking about something pretty substantial.
It may be different this time around. Some of his remarks have been released in advance by the White House, and it looks like climate change is going to be top of the agenda. He's going to say that climate change impacts every country on the planet, but it's a serious threat to global security and a threat to our national security, and therefore impacts how our military defends our country. So, I mean, and this is obviously a very, very central to the role of the Coast Guard Academy, so it's going to be very relevant to these cadets who are about to graduate and go out and be officers in the Coast Guard. I think they're going to be very interested to hear what he has to say about climate change and about how the military will be having an impact on, you know, how military policy will be addressing climate change.
And I know that you talked to some cadets, and they were actually echoing some of these thoughts even before they knew what was in the speech, Harriet.
Yeah, I was privileged to get to talk to a couple of the graduating cadets yesterday, and I asked them, you know, what would you really like to hear the president say? And Justin Sherman, who's actually the cadet who's graduating top of the class, he's going to get to speak himself today in front of the president, in front of his class. He had some ideas about what he would like to hear the president say.
Definitely, I'm hoping to hear kind of that piece of environmental protection and how things have been changing. We have a very strong program for search and rescue and migrant interdiction and drug interdiction. But we're headed up into the Arctic. And so it'll be interesting. It's been a really hot topic in the Coast Guard, Arctic policy. So I'm hoping he'll say something about Arctic policy and you know, what does he think about it? How does he view it kind of within the context of where the United States is going, where our military is going?
And, of course, you know, Arctic policy is becoming a hot topic precisely because of climate change, that much more navigation is now possible with the retreat of Arctic pack ice. So the various countries that ring the Arctic are laying claim to the resources in the Arctic. And it is something where the Coast Guard is finding itself more and more engaged. And they're talking more and more about Arctic policy.
And of course, migrant interdiction, something he mentions, something that's very important in North and South America, something that's important in the Mediterranean right now, and also as we're seeing Southeast Asia. Really quickly, Harriet, what else has been different for these students? It's the first class to go through an academy entirely since the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This is a slightly different Coast Guard Academy than the one that, you know, President Bush spoke to several years ago.
It is, yes. I mean, there's an active gay and lesbian society on campus, so that's something that's, you know, just completely new for the military, and this class has gone all the way through with that in place. It's also, the Academy's made a great deal of effort over the past decade or so to bring in more women, to bring in more diversity. It's one of the more diverse of the military academies. It's one that places an emphasis on graduating more women. So, you know, the face of military training is definitely changing.
And one last thing for you, Harriet. Funding for the Coast Guard is, of course, something that Congress has to make sure happens. Where do we stand as far as the Coast Guard moving forward?
Yes. I mean, that, you know, that touches on what President Obama is going to be saying today, of course. If he's saying that the Coast Guard needs to take a bigger role in looking at how we impact climate change, then, of course, he's going to have to think about how we fund their mission. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, just came out with a report. They just reported it to Congress last week, saying that the Coast Guard's acquisition funding has fallen short of what it needs to fully recapitalize its assets. That means its boats and its planes are getting older, and they don't have enough money to replace them. The GAO has warned of what it calls a potentially significant capability gap. In other words, they're not going to be able to fulfill the missions that are being given to them with the equipment that they have. So it'll be interesting also to see if the president has anything to say on that.
Harriet Jones is reporting on the president's visit to the Coast Guard Academy as he gives the commencement speech. We'll be talking a lot about climate change. If you want to follow Harriet all day long on Twitter, she's at WNPR Harriet. She'll be letting you know what the president is saying, and we'll have more reporting on All Things Considered later on today. Enjoy the day, Harriet. It's really one of the best days of the year down there, and it should be a beautiful day for the commencement.
Thank you. I will.
This is Where We Live, and I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We want to turn to the state here a little bit, away from national politics. Now, last week, Governor Daniel Molloy commented on his proposal to repeal stiffer drug possession penalties for those caught within 1,500 feet of a school or daycare. The current law exposes many urban defendants to harsher sentences. In his comments to reporters, Molloy said, to treat those folks differently because they live in those communities is patently unfair and, if not racist in intent, is racist in outcome. His use of the term racist was criticized by Republicans. Here's House Minority Leader Themis Claridis talking to NBC Connecticut. Then we will hear Molloy's response to her criticism.
The word should never come up. He supports legislation. I may not agree with him, but I don't question what his motive is. I don't say you support drug addicts or drug dealers, because I would never think that.
We know that it has a disparate racial impact. We know that.
Okay, so that's Governor Molloy responding to Themis Claridis. So first of all, Daniela, maybe let's just walk through what exactly he said in response to what, and whether or not we're making too big a deal or just the right amount of a deal over the use of one word.
Well, you know, you gave a good rundown of what he said. He used this term. He didn't directly call folks racist, but he did say that, you know, this policy is racist and that, the implication was that using that word, it's such a loaded word. It's such a powerful word. And, you know, the Republicans and even some Democrats were quite upset that he would use that word. I mean, when Themis Claridis came up to talk to us about that, she was extremely angry. She sort of put this in the context of Molloy's sort of general tone with folks, that he is a bully and that he does use inflammatory language, you know, that this was sort of part and parcel. So this is the same guy who, you know, went after Mike Pence and did, you know, all these things, that this is sort of part of his personality. And it didn't need to be part of this discussion. I think a lot of people felt that he could have made the points that he needed to make without using that very powerful word.
But it is part of his personality. He's used inflammatory language on our program before. He's used inflammatory language in front of reporters before. Should anyone be terribly surprised or, frankly, have their feelings hurt so badly by something said by the governor?
Well, you know, that's an argument, too. I mean, people could say, well, you know, this is the guy.
It's not like it's out of character, is my point.
Exactly. I mean, you know, this is who he is. And, you know, he's going to use, you know, sometimes clumsily, sometimes maybe even people could argue inappropriately. But, you know, he's going to make his point. And, you know, for them to sort of take umbrage at this, you know, some of Molloy's defenders were saying, you know, get over yourselves, basically.
Well, and the umbrage goes beyond just, you know, getting upset and going up and talking to Capitol reporters. This is the second time now we've talked about this in the program. The language by a Democrat has so upset Republicans that they've essentially shut down business. This happened once with Minnie Gonzalez in the Judiciary Committee, and there was a kerfuffle, and all of a sudden a whole bunch of bills that were supposed to be voted on weren't voted on. Now we have Themis Claridis and other Republicans essentially walking away from work for a while saying, we're so upset we can't work. I mean, this is a pattern that maybe we haven't seen in the past.
Yeah, and they were scolded by, you know, by the Democrats for that. You know, you're just going to take your toys and go home. This is ridiculous. You guys have work to do. There's only, you know, limited time left in the session. There's a lot of important bills that need to be taken care of. So, you know, just get to work and stop pouting.
Malloy's a bully. Claridis is a drama queen. If this cycle could just repeat itself constantly, and it could be very, very tiresome for all the rest of us. So, I mean, and I don't know what we do about that, because that's very much ingrained on both of their characters. And this really is one of those a plague on both their houses situations. I mean, Malloy should not have used that word. On the other hand, there are two problems with the Republicans for which they should not be let off the hook. The first one is the one to which Daniela has just alluded. I mean, they just cannot be this 12-year-old girl who runs into her room and locks the door and sobs next to her One Direction posters and pounds her little fists on her pillow every time something like this happens. I'm speaking about them collectively now, the Republicans. You know, I mean, they are not, as you suggested, up there to monitor their feelings to see whether they've been hurt or not. They're up there to either pass good laws or avoid the passage of bad laws. So that's number one. Number two, you know, I mean, I don't know. I went through this whole Malloy thing a few times, and I read Ken Dixon's piece on it. I guess it was actually a specific question from Ken that triggered this initial thing, in which Ken, like a lot of reporters, invited Malloy to sort of, would you like to use the term racist?
You know? And not so many words, but more or less.
Yeah, and it turns out, yeah, I would like to use the term like racist. I mean, it's too bad. And he was wrong to say it. On the other hand, I think it is fair to say I think Claridis's response to this whole second chance thing from day one has been very disappointing. I think it is fair to say, look, African-American citizens, people of color, they don't use drugs at any higher rate than white people, but they get locked up for it more and they stay in prison longer, even though there's no real – so there's something wrong here. Either that bothers you or it doesn't. If you're cool with it, it's not completely unreasonable to use a term like racist. You know, if it's okay with you that there's this huge disparity in incarceration rates over drug offenses that doesn't parallel a disparity in drug use, if that's not a problem for you, we kind of have to ask why that would be. Why wouldn't you be bothered by that?
Well, and I guess one thing to ask then to you, Bill, is just from the politics of it, if what you're trying to do is get people to come along with you, you're trying to get people who maybe aren't predisposed to see that argument as clearly as Colin just laid it out. When you inject the word racist, it can shut down an argument pretty quickly. At the end of the day, you don't really want to come along and agree with anybody on any level who says, if you don't agree with me, you know what? You're a racist.
You know, I agree in part with what Colin said. Look, the national Republicans especially are in the business of ginning up a phony outrage, especially over racial issues, because they are playing a racial politics, whether or not they acknowledge it to themselves, so that when President Obama says that Skip Gates shouldn't have been arrested in his own home, or that Trayvon Martin, you know, should have been had his fundamental human right to live respected. All those things they're in the business of getting angry to please their own constituency, and they do us great harm when they do that. These Republicans in this legislature responded to the word racist, and I agree that the response is overdrawn and it's played out. The word racist means a couple of things. But one of the things it means is that you believe that there are differences between the races such that some race other than your own is inferior to yours. And secondly, it carries with it an inevitable connotation of loathing, of disdain at the very least. And to call someone a racist, is even more than fascist or – I mean it's right up there with Nazi. It's one of the worst things you can say. And to say that something has either racist intent or effect – is without a doubt to send the barely coded message that the people involved are trafficking in those kinds of feelings. And while they may – while we all carry cultural baggage with us to how we see each of these things, you just don't do that. I just want to say one last thing, and that is that we have this marketplace of ideas. We're supposed to be having real discussions, real substantive, logical, civil discussions over stuff that matters, and we don't. It's breaking down. If you want to bring people together, you don't use this kind of language.
You've talked about this marketplace of ideas before, Bill, and it's like we're in a store with nothing on the shelves, and that's the thing. You're looking around, and there's a box of Cheerios, and that's it.
And instead, people just – let me say there are many wonderful ideas out there. We can't get them into the mainstream because they've been all displaced by this cartoonish, hateful invective
and empty advertising that now occupies almost all of our politics at the center of it. There are plenty of good ideas out there. We've just stopped talking about them, and we don't talk to each other in a tone of voice or under the kinds of rules that make that kind of engagement possible.
Well, let's just have a little bit more context for this, because in the midst of all this stuff, there's a couple of other issues that really do have to do with race and class and document status. The Senate passed a bill to allow the children of undocumented immigrants the ability to apply for college tuition assistance. The House also debated and after many hours approved a bill to allow undocumented students and others from out of state to more easily receive in-state tuition rates. One of the bill's opponents is Representative Vin Candelora.
And, you know, this bill really stinks because the thought of somebody that's going to be able to just move here, we're not giving the same benefit to people that are residents from other states necessarily. We're giving these benefits to people that are here illegally that can't even be employed after they graduate.
So, Daniela, I guess I thought that we had this debate years ago, and I thought that this was fairly settled now, but we're debating. So what are we debating now around this?
Well, so we did have the debate a few years ago, and the legislature did agree to allow people who came here as children with their undocumented parents came here illegally with, you know, without the proper immigration status to get those in-state tuition rates, which are significantly lower. But the requirement was they had to attend high school here for 4 years. And now, you know, there was some looking around to other states, you know, New York, the requirement, I think, is 2 years. In Rhode Island, it's three. And there was an idea that, you know, Connecticut's four-year rule was too high. So a fairly – I mean, it's not a new policy. You know, it's a fairly modest change in an existing policy, although it would have a great impact on many people's lives or some people's lives. It's unclear how many. But it was nevertheless, you know, the opportunity for a 7-hour filibuster on the part of the Republicans to, you know, really open up the whole can of worms again and discuss all the ins and outs and the pros and cons of immigration policy. And, you know, ultimately the bill passed. But there was a lot of discussion, a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of, you know, commentary about it.
The pros and cons of immigration policy. Seen the pros and cons of Colin, who really deserves to get in-state tuition in the great state of Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sort of not very far below the surface of this debate is that kind of conversation about the zero-sum game, right? That you heard it in some of the comments made by legislators, including legislators I like a lot, including Arthur O'Neill, who's talked about bumping, this notion that somehow or other these people would bump other people. And it's there in Candelora's remarks, too. And I mean, first of all, I have to say that the people that we're talking about right now are born in a different culture where they actually speak a different language. They've made this incredibly perilous and arduous journey. They got here somehow that was unbelievably dangerous. Once they got here, in many cases, what we would think of as their support systems began to fall apart. The ones that I've talked to are often very dependent on the kindness of strangers or near strangers and a very rickety support system just to survive. They're trying to master a new language and a new culture. Meanwhile, your kid woke up on second base, basically. He drew his first breath. He's on second base. Not because he hit a double, but because he was born there. So if you're worried that one of these kids, you know, who made this incredible journey from Guatemala to avoid death squads and everything else and grew up speaking Spanish and stuff, if you're worried that he's going to run past your kid to third base and home, maybe you should disconnect your kid's Xbox and take his bong away and tell him to suck it up. Because really, I mean, that notion anyway, that they're going to take this thing away from my kid, it's such an incredible commentary on our notion of privilege.
And Bill, a part of that is this, again, an argument about people are going to come here to our state and essentially displace our people. One of the interesting things about this argument is Connecticut has this unbelievable out-migration of people, especially young people. We would, if not for immigration, both those undocumented and mostly documented, Connecticut would be trailing the population game almost everybody in the entire country. Connecticut would be losing people hand over fist if we didn't have people from other places coming here. And so essentially what we seem to be saying is we don't want smart people who are motivated to go to school to come here and, you know, do stuff.
Really, or anyone who's here voluntarily, you know, you could almost say. You know, I was thinking, listening to this conversation, that one of the ironies here is the New York Times just reported is that the difference between in-state and out-state tuitions is closing, you know, year by year. And so the entire issue is going to simply go away when it's no longer any kind of an advantage to be from within your state. because of the cost of education. I mentioned Joey Courtney yesterday and the fights over how we finance it, who's been deeply involved in this fight over the cost of higher education and how we finance it. But everybody's getting screwed here. Everybody's getting screwed. And so I agree strongly. The whole fight over immigration, the idea of an immigration policy is to keep people out, but if they're in, to lift them up. And ours does the opposite. We can't keep them out because of a lot of other policies, actually. And when they get here, we keep them down. And keeping them down is the worst thing you could possibly do. It breeds an underclass. It undermines all the basic values of your society. Work hard to keep them out. But anybody who's in America, we have such a vested interest in lifting them up and giving them that chance, and we're blowing it.
And there's one more piece of legislation this week, Danielle, that sort of addresses some of these things, a vote having to do with undocumented drivers and driver's licenses, essentially drive-only licenses, just to acknowledge the fact that there's an awful lot of undocumented people here. Maybe the state doesn't want to give them full IDs, but it wants to give them something so they can drive around.
Yeah, and again, that was a policy that was passed a couple of years ago and is just now being implemented by the DMV, and there were some tweaks made to that, and that passed as well. But at the same time, as the House was debating this bill on in-state tuition upstairs in the Senate, they discussed very briefly and passed with bipartisan support a bill that would allow undocumented immigrant students to receive financial aid. And that, in some ways, might be more significant. I guess they can't receive it now because they don't have Social Security numbers, so they can't fill out the FAFSA forms and the other documents needed to apply for state financial aid. But this bill would let them do it. And some of the Republicans in the Senate spoke very eloquently in support of that proposal, talking exactly about what Colin was saying, about giving people a hand up and a chance to start a good life here in the U.S. So it's kind of interesting, the comparison between the two debates.
I was impressed by the way where Linares and Fasano and some of those guys came out. I was impressed by their language. And it's good to hear Republicans talking that way, too. If we're going to kick them in the pants when they screw up, we should say something nice about them when they get it right.
But before we take a break, Colin, I just want to address an email here from Greg, who says, discussing the racial impacts of policies is not inflammatory or improper. People who don't want to acknowledge that racism exists want to make any discussion of racism taboo. If we don't talk about racism, we will never make any progress in eliminating it. And I fully agree with what Greg has to say, and it's something that we've tried to tackle a lot on our program. I'm wondering if you just might talk that through with me for a moment, because to me, the use of the word racist in this particular context, I'm not sure if it made a whole lot of sense, but certainly talking about things that are policies that might indeed be racist, that's very important. I don't know. I mean, what do you make of Greg's comment?
Well, what I make of it is, I mean, I think we are in the middle of a national conversation about this. And I do differ with Bill about this a little bit. I don't think actually the bar for racism is quite as difficult to clear as he made it. And there is a kind of, the Bush administration talked about the soft bigotry of low expectations. Well, there's a soft racism. And it's basically saying the way things are is okay. Not because I hate black people or think they're inferior or lesser. I just don't care about it enough to change it. But the way things are, and when we look at mass incarceration rates, we look at people dying in terms of their involvement with police, we look at a whole series of things that still affect people of color in a very negative way. And if you say, I don't care enough to make any change, maybe that's not racism, but then maybe there needs to be another word for it. But I would agree with Greg, too. I think it's fine to talk about that. If you don't care about it, why not? What does that say about you?
Greg and Colin, I think you may have changed my opinion around on the use of the word very quickly, Bill.
Well, just that, sure. But if you're going to charge racism, you got to really nail it. And simply to say that somebody supports a different sentencing policy than you do, and therefore you use the word racist with reference to those people. If you want to be a governor or any kind of political leader, your job is to bring people together and your job is to create a different atmosphere. Throw that word around without the facts to support it, and the people that feel smeared by it will never talk to you again.
It's a good conversation. Bill Curry is a columnist for Salon.com, our political analyst. Danielle Altamari is here. She's State House reporter for the Hartford Courant and our own Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back, we'll talk about delay on the big casino plan, and we'll also talk about something that sounds like maybe just the worst idea ever, powdered alcohol. That's next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, with 137 land trusts, little tiny Connecticut has emerged as a national leader in the land conservation movement. We'll take a closer look at what these land trusts are and what they do and their role in conservation efforts. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe is here, along with Bill Curry and Daniela Altamari. Earlier in the show, we previewed President Barack Obama's commencement address at the Coast Guard Academy. Among those in attendance, Governor Dan Malloy. Later in the day, Malloy heads over to the grand opening of the Tanger Outlets at Foxwoods Resort Casino. Now, if you haven't heard, Foxwoods is teaming up with Mohegan Sun to open up at least one additional casino in Connecticut. They're doing this, they say, to save jobs at their existing facilities in Southeast Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York. Everyone's building casinos these days. There was a big push on that we talked quite a bit about, Daniela, to build more casinos, maybe up to three in the state, in partnership with the tribes. All of a sudden, this has been like way ratcheted back. We're talking now one casino and maybe not for a while.
Yeah, maybe not with the final vote not coming until next year. So we'll see.
Well, why taking – after all of this rush, I mean, all of a sudden, people who can't really get together quickly on bills at all are now running to try to get this casino put together, and then they back way off again. I thought it was urgent.
Well, yeah. I mean, they brought, you know, hundreds of people to the state capitol, you know, union laborers and other folks who want to see this passed. They're calling it, you know, a jobs bill, basically. You know, now it's cooled a little bit, and, you know, some criticism is emerging, and, you know, I guess we'll see what happens next year.
Yeah, so Colin, the fact that we've pushed off this casino, this sort of seems like the cooling off period that maybe makes a little bit more sense for what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't started parachuting in the way Danielle has been over there just grinding it out with the legislature, so she knows more about why they're doing what they're doing. I haven't been there yet for the sort of the backroom gossip. I'm assuming this is a little bit of a finger in the wind issue. It's also there's one good thing about it, which is it looks like what they want to do is vote on an actual proposal that they'll know what the proposal is. So is it going to be East Windsor? Is it going to be East Hartford? Whose municipal leadership is sufficiently depraved and desperate to come in here with a proposal like that one? It's probably better to do that. Not that it's good to do any of this, but it's probably better to do that than some kind of nebulous enabling legislation that's going to result in God knows what.
I have to ask, with just the last couple of minutes left, I want to tackle something that's very, very important. And I don't know, Bill, this sort of flew under the radar for me. So the federal government approved something called powdered alcohol. It's essentially a powder form of alcohol, and it comes in a couple different flavors, including Cosmopolitan, which you put in the water, and much like Kool-Aid, you dissolve into a drink. Despite the fact that this seemingly could be misused by children all around the world, this is something the federal government has said yes to. Now, Connecticut, amongst other states, are saying, well, maybe no.
How could that possibly happen?
What could possibly go wrong?
Really, you know, you have to be on the lookout for paranoia. I was thinking of Lick-O-Maid, actually. If you remember, do you remember Lick-O-Maid?
I don't remember Lick-O-Maid.
They just took the Kool-Aid powder and they made it into a candy, and kids poured it out of their hands and just licked it straight. No water, just the powder.
Well, I think one of the worries –
Colin, I think, cooks with this stuff.
Right.
Yeah, actually, yeah. So,
you
I think it could be the beginning of civilization.
What do you actually make with powdered alcohol, Colin? What's the recipe?
Trouble.
Yeah.
I do want to say that, of course, one of the concerns here among the legislature, obviously, is that people will snort this, because
yes,
anything that's in powdered form will sooner or later be snorted. I believe it was Pamela Stanesky who said, kids will snort anything, which, by the way, is the name of a new CTN reality show hosted by Pamela Stanesky. But I just have to say one thing. The company, in defending itself, said, that's ridiculous. The alcohol burns when you snort it, and it takes 60 minutes to snort the equivalent of, I think, an ounce of vodka. So that's one place you don't want to get an internship, because that's clearly what they – okay, Justin, let's see how long it takes you to snort.
The only reason they're talking about this is to make the casino seem like a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay, they just wanted something out there. The casino is such an awful idea.
Well, I will say, of all the things that the federal government has decided to leave to the states, the fact that the state has to now debate how to regulate powdered alcohol, maybe it's a good thing. Hopefully over at the state legislature, they're taking notes on this. No snorting of powdered alcohol.
Colin could be the powdered alcohol commissioner, liquor commissioner for powdered alcohol.
Bill Curry, all powdered things.
Bill Curry writes a very good column for Salon.com. com. Colin McEnroe is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. And Danielle Altomare covers the State House for the Hartford Current. Thank you to you all for coming in today. Thanks also to Harriet Jones, who's covering the president today. More on the president's visit to the Coast Guard coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered. Thanks to our producer, Tucker Ives, today. It's The Wheelhouse and Where We Live.